Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and organize around the eco-socialist platform that Angela Walker and I ran on. So we're going to be speaking with Diane Feely, a retired UAW worker about the strike going on. It's going to be mostly what we do today, but I just want to say a few words up front about what I'm sure is on a lot of people's minds who listen to this podcast. One is Cornel West deciding he's going to run as an independent. And I'll just say briefly, I think that decision is about as dumb as his initial decision to run without a campaign team or campaign plan in place with Nick Bryan's People's Party, which is a Potokum village of a party with no ballot access. And West was on there on the People's Party advisory board. He should have known better. Now he's claiming it's easier to get on the ballot as an independent than as a Green Party candidate. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's losing the Green Party ballot line in big states like California, Florida, and Texas. And now he's going to have to mount massive petition drives, 219,000 and change in California, 145,000 in Texas, 113,151 in Florida. I mean, this is just, frankly, incompetent foolishness. It's not a serious campaign. And we'll probably want to talk about it more next week. And the other thing to note is this war in Israel that broke out today. The Hamas offensive is not surprising since Israel's been brutally expelling and often killing Palestinians to seize more land and property in the West Bank with accelerating intensity over the last year. The unbalanced response of most U.S. politicians is not helping, from Biden to many congressional leaders, or giving unconditional support to Israel. That's immoral because it covers up the crimes against the Palestinians by Israel. And it's politically stupid because it fails to help create the conditions for a political solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Just adds fuel to the fire. And countries around the world are taking different positions, but just, you know, where I think we need to be is we need to condemn attacks on civilians, which Hamas is doing and now Israel's doing in response. And peace will require justice, which means upholding Palestinian rights and resolving the land question. And that's what we should be advocating, urging this war to end and, you know, get people back to the peace table. They haven't had negotiations since 2014, and the U.S. hasn't done much to promote that. We do have the leverage of BDS, and we're not using it. But there's plenty to talk about there. But today, let's bring on Diane, because we want to talk about this UAW strike, which is really significant in terms of when we talk about organizing around an eco-socialist program. This strike is really important. Now, Diane has been active in social movements going back to the civil rights, the anti-Vietnam War, the feminist movements in the 1960s and 70s. In that time, she was in the Socialist Workers' Party, like Peter Camejo, who many of you know, who ran many years later as the Green Party candidate for governor a couple times, and then as Ralph Nader's vice presidential running mate in 2004. And in fact, Diane was a Socialist Workers' Party candidate for the governor of New York in 1978. And that's something we have in common. We both run for governor of New York. She took an auto worker job in New Jersey when the Socialist Worker Party, they called it the turn to industry. They got their members into industries. But she was soon expelled from the SWP. That's a whole other story in history we don't need to go into. But she moved to Detroit and helped form the feminist anti-racist socialist organization called Solidarity, in which she is still active. I'm a member. And she's co-editor of its publication, Against the Current. And she continued to work in auto, participating in rank and file reform movements. And I know from personal experience that, you know, Diane is one of the most solid, consistent, serious activists I've ever met. She came to Syracuse in 2017 to help with my campaign, and she put my younger volunteers half her age to shame with all the phone calling she did. And she's fresh off the picket line from this morning. So she's a retired auto worker now, but retirees can still participate in the union in the current strike, which Diane is doing, and she's going to give us a report on what's going on with the strike and, you know, what, you know, how we can help. So, Diane, why don't you take it away?
Well, thank you for that long and laudatory introduction. I'm going to start by talking about the actual demands of the contract and the situation we're in. And I would like to also talk about the reform movement, because we now have a negotiating team that is led by a reformer that I supported. And that's a whole other story, but I'm going to start with the demands. So we have 10 demands, and they are really comprehensive because essentially they are to reverse the concessions that the auto workers have taken, not just since the bailout of 2009, but really since the recession of 79. So, and then to go forward. Okay, so I'm going to just read them off. To eliminate tiers. That is, there are workers working next to each other where one worker is making half of what the other worker makes and doesn't have the same benefits. Big wage increases. And we want this because basically over the last 10 years, we've lost 20% of the purchasing power of what we're earning. We want to restore COLA, which is a cost of living adjustment, which we used to have in our contract and was a helped us overcome inflation. And the other thing it did was with each contract, that amount would be rolled, or most of that amount would be rolled into our wage. So that's how our wages increased. We want a defined pension benefit for all workers. Basically, anybody hired after 2006 does not have the right to a pension. We want to establish post-retirement medical benefits, which, again, people who've come in since 2006 don't have the right to. We want to be able to strike over plant closings. There have been 65 plant closings over the last decade. So this is obviously very important. We want a working family protection program. Many auto workers are required to work 10-hour days. When I worked at Ford in New Jersey in 79, I worked a 50-hour work week 1 week, followed by a 58-hour work week the following week. And then they would ask me if I wanted to work voluntary overtime, which I always refused. But some people feel they have to work that overtime for their families. So the idea is that we wouldn't be required to work overtimes, especially if we had our wages increased. And that would provide for more workers. And it would give people who are working long hours the right to have a life outside of the factory. And that's something that we really want to talk a lot about. All of the automation hasn't made our jobs easier. It's just eliminated a lot of the jobs. Why shouldn't we have the right to a reduced workload if these with the automation? We want to end the abuse of temporary workers. And this is really a huge problem because workers are hired as temporaries and they're often kept as temporaries for years. I mean, I meet people all the time who spent 6 or 8 years working every day, but they were still temporaries. And that meant they had few benefits and, of course, a much lower wage. So when you have someone who basically has no rights on the job, essentially, for years and years and years, you can really abuse them in many, many ways. And that's, of course, what management does all the time. And they have no sense of will they be hired as a full-timer. And then we want a significant increase for retiree pay. Retirees can only have their retirement pensions increased if at bargaining time, the active workers fight for that. And this is one of the things that's really important about our union. We're an industrial union, and so we're used to everybody basically having about the same wage. I mean, maybe if you have a slightly higher job, you might make 5 cents more an hour. But essentially, everybody has the same a pay rate and everybody has the same benefits. And in fact, there are generations of auto workers. So for example, the current president of the UAW, his grandfather was an auto worker. Other people I know, their third and fourth generation families have worked for Ford or for Chrysler or for General Motors. So the sense of solidarity that you feel for the generations is even greater because these are actually literally your family members. And this sense of solidarity is very strong. Well, retirees have not had a raise in their pension since the bailout in 2009. So that's when you talk to workers on the line, you'll find that maybe the first thing that they want is to end the tiers because they see that as inequality, basic inequality on the job, and they want to end that. And the second thing many of them will say is, we want to raise the benefit for the retirees because they know that their grandparents are having a hard time making a living. Okay, so these are essentially our demands. And I would say that at the beginning of the negotiating process, the companies basically felt, okay, we've made a lot of money, we've made a lot of profit, so for this next contract, we agree that workers should get a raise, but we don't want to do anything else. We don't want to end tiers, we don't want to end our use of temporaries, we don't want to give the retirees anything. And their justification is, well, we're building all of these new battery plants, and we have to spend our money on those plants. Of course, they never tell you that the federal government has already given like $140 million in various loans and tax credits and actual money. I mean, it's really amazing how much money's been given. I live in Michigan, where our, of course, state government has given a lot too. So they're saying, well, that's where we've got to put our money. But of course, the fact of the matter is they've already made $20 billion this year in profits. So it's not like they're, short on cash. And in fact, the profits that they've made over the last decade, what have they done with those profits? Have they invested them wisely? No, they've given stock buybacks, and CEOs like Mary Barra from General Motors, you know, she gets like $28 million a year. So while they're stingy with the workers who are actually producing, they're very generous to their stockholders and to the high CEOs. So going into the negotiations, basically all they want to do is, you know, oh, maybe a 9% raise or something on that order. So looking at what we're saying is, what we want is not just a raise, we actually want to make institutional changes. So they were very reluctant to do that. Now, I can say to you after 4 weeks of the strike that it is clear that we are going to be able to get a contract, not that we have it yet, but that contains a lot of what we've already asked for. For example, both Ford and Stellantis have agreed that they will reinstitute COLA. They're talking about at least 20 or 21% wage increases. Both Stellantis and Ford have agreed to put in our master contract that we have the right to strike when we're threatened with plant shutdowns. This has never been in a UAW contract, ever, ever, ever. So we've really broken through the wall of the resistance of the corporations in a very meaningful way. And we've even gotten from General Motors on Friday morning a terrific concession that they are going to bring the EV production into the master contract. Now, I really want to see what this works out to be, because they've spent millions of dollars at least in setting up joint ventures just so they wouldn't have to deal with us at our wages and benefits. And they're setting up these battery production operations and paying people, you know, $16 an hour. So this new concession by General Motors is, again, historic. I thought we would end up with a pretty good contract, and then we would have to go out and organize all of these plants. But it may be that we are able to get an even better contract. So how is it that we've been able to do something that the corporations really didn't want to do, and that many people, both media experts and I would say the political opposition in the UAW said were impossible. I mean, people told me, no, we'll never get COLA back. That's something, you know, that's from the 20th century. Now we're in the 21st century. And to talk about job security, well, that's not going to happen either. Okay. So basically, we were able to elect, and I can talk about this a little bit later, we were able to elect a reform slate so that of the 14 top officers in the UAW, seven of them are reformers that were elected on our slate, and another one is an independent. So we have a slight majority. And that grouping knew it had to do two things differently once they took office. And the president was only, who had to run, had to be in a runoff, only actually won his office in March of this year. So we had a very short amount of time. I mean, in comparison to, say, the Teamsters, who had more than a year to organize their contract campaign, we basically had, you know, 6 months. So the first thing was we had to organize the workforce. That is, for years we've been told we have to accept concessions. It's the only way that we can have a job. Otherwise, the plant will close. Whether it moves to the suburbs or the South or Mexico or China, you know, whatever it was, but it's not going to be here anymore. And that seemed like a big threat to people, because it was something not only was the company saying that, but the actual leadership that was negotiating the contract was telling you, you've got to vote yes on this concession because otherwise you don't have a job. So this lowered people's expectations. Even if they wanted more, they felt they had to vote for at least keeping their job. So you had a kind of automized workforce that was used to having very low expectations. How do you turn that around? How do you make people feel that they are empowered to fight for a good contract? So that's where the idea of having a contract campaign came up. And in fact, we used a lot of the techniques that the Teamsters used, TDU, a reform caucus in the Teamsters developed. You know, red shirt Wednesdays, where you wear a red shirt, talking, having short meetings with your coworkers and talking about the contract and what's possible, even organizing practice pickets. The other thing that was done was you could sign a card or go to the Facebook page or the email or the web page, sign up and say you'd like to get messages. And the international would be sending you a text message and an email message every week about what's the state of the negotiations. So all of these things began to percolate among at least a larger group. And then the International also had to design a campaign which was remarkably different from the kind of lackluster negotiations that we've always had. That is, yes, they would ask us what were our demands, and then they would put it together in an omnibus package, and who knows what they did with it. But in the end, even though we said we were against tiers, tiers showed up again. So, and when the negotiations actually started, you know, you didn't know what was going on, what was happening there. If you were out on a picket line, for example, General Motors workers were on a picket line in 2019. They were out for 40 days. They were told, don't talk to the press about what you think you deserve or what you want. Because if you talk to the press, that will mess up the negotiations. Only the elected leaders can talk to the press. So that silenced people. Of course, some people didn't go along with it, but the fact is that was the stance. And in fact, the communications department of the UAW was told when they were asked by the press, what's happening, what's this, no comment, no comment. So everything was shut down. Well, this time, the negotiations traditionally open with the president shaking hands with the CEO of each of the big three. This time around, instead of doing that, Sean Fain, the new president, went to a Ford plant, went to a Stellantis plant, which is the what Chrysler's name is now, went to a Ford plant and shook hands with the workers as they were going in or coming out and saying, my responsibility is to take your demands to the negotiating table. Well, this one gesture opened it up. People could see things are going to be done differently. So since that very beginning, the people began to understand, yeah, this is our negotiations, not just something that's off. And in fact, over the course of the summer and the beginning of the fall, in preparation for the actual negotiations going on, he would have short meetings once a week in which he would talk about the amount of profits that the different corporations were made, and take questions from people about or comments about what we should be doing. So more and more people were watching this. By the time the contracts really got going underway, there were 29,000 people who were watching on Fridays. Now, I don't know how many people watched yesterday, but last week, I think it was something like 70,000. And of course, it's now circulating through the plants. So there's really a raised expectation about the demands. And when I was out this morning, I was out on a picket line. These workers have been out for 3 weeks. And they say, yeah, we'd like to go back to work, but we want a good contract. We can stay out. So there's a real esprit de corps that's happening. And of course, many unions and organizations are going to the picket lines. I try to go out at least twice a week for a couple of hours each. And people are bringing food to the picket lines. A lot of locals and regions have opened up food pantries. So that's one way that we can, as people who aren't directly involved, can organize to support them. So I would say that another aspect of the strike strategy was outlined just a couple hours before the first, as negotiations develop, the UAW picks one corporation to be the target corporation, continues negotiating with that company, and then if that company balks, they might go on strike, but only against that company and all of their plants. But it became pretty obvious that as Fain was talking about all these billionaires and the billionaire class and how we have to stand up as workers and this is our power, it became pretty obvious that we're not going to select one company. We're going to go for all three. So the question was, well, are all 150,000 going out, you know, on September 15th? Or will it be some kind of a selective strike? And not only did it turn out to be a selective strike, but actually the first night, the contract was up at midnight. So workers walk out at midnight. They picked one assembly plant from each company. So each company was facing a strike, but it wasn't the whole, all of us, it was only about 13,000 workers. So as the weeks have gone on, as the negotiations continue, those companies that are coming to the table with better demand, better offers, find that they're not going to be penalized like the other companies might. So in a sense, they're kind of in competition with each other. So in the second week, Ford came up and had some really good good ideas that would meet some of our demands. So for the second week of the strike, the UAW decided to take out all the parts distribution centers for both Stellantis and General Motors. That meant 38 more centers in 21 different states would be out. And this is an extremely profitable operation. They, of course, sell plants all over the world. I have a friend who's worked there, worked at Mopar for 29 years, and he sends parts all over the, he sends international parts. They make something like 46% profit. So they have a huge profit margin. But the workers are at you could say, the third tier. So that over the years, it's not just two tiers, it's actually three or more tiers. In fact, one person counted up, they were actually at GM, there were something like 12 different tiers. So so one of the demands is that not only would the tiers cover everybody in the assembly plant, but that the tiers would be eradicated from the parts distribution plants as well. So now during the third week, Stellantis stepped up, which was great because I always think of them as the most profit-driven company. But they had some good things to offer. And so they were rewarded by nothing went out for them, but there were two other assembly plants taken out, one by one of Ford's and one of General Motors. So then yesterday was yet another week. So we got an update on Friday, and it turned out that GM was aware that its most profitable plant in the whole world was about to go out on strike. That's the plant that they have in Arlington, Texas, which makes full-size vans and SUVs. They make something like 345,000 a year. And each one, as each one walks out the door, you can say that's another $10,000 profit. So when they were faced with that, they decided to come in with quite a good offer. So now you can say all three of the companies are involved in serious negotiations. So we've stopped the clock in the sense of we didn't send anybody else out on strike, but we have 25,000 workers who are out on strike, and we're still supporting the picket lines. And we have the threat of a strike in front of us, of escalating that. So as Sean Fain said yesterday, Walter Reuther once said that power was when you go up against the most powerful company in the world, which at that time was General Motors, and you can force them to say yes when they want to say no. And that's what we're in now. We're in a situation and we can escalate. Only 1/6 of our workforce is currently out on strike. We can choose to escalate if we want in order to force the three corporations to say yes when they want to say no. So that's really where we are on the strike and on the picket line and on the negotiations. There's a big rally that's taking place at Local 551, the Ford assembly plant in Chicago, as I'm talking to you, and so things are moving along. So the question is, will the companies continue their serious bargaining, or will it be necessary for us to increase the muscle? So now I can talk just a few minutes about how we got to this point, because actually there had been the leadership of our union had been in a caucus formation since the 1940s. And they controlled not only the national offices, but because they controlled the national offices, they were able to control all the local offices. So you could say 99% of all of the elected officials in the UAW belong to one caucus, and that caucus could impose caucus conditions on its membership. For example, in the caucus, you cannot run for office after the age of 65. That's sort of their way of getting rid of the old guard. So the question: what all of these years, there has been an opposition, you can say most of the time we were pretty small. But we elected delegates and went to the conventions and spoke. And the two issues that were important to us were having more democracy and not taking concessions. And we were often laughed at, whistled. They had whistles and horns that they would bring in, and very disrespectful. So in the 80s, when the concessions came in, there was the strongest reform movement. It was called New Directions, and it was actually able to elect one regional director. Now we have three, but then it was one regional director, and that person was able to come up with non-concessionary contracts. And so the whole administration caucus concentrated on getting rid of him, and they were able to defeat him, and the caucus dissipated. Most recently, in the 2009 period, when there was the bankruptcy and the talk of bailouts, it was disgusting to see UAW officials going to Washington with the CEOs and saying, yes, give all this money to General Motors, give all this money to Chrysler. And so we had an auto caravan, and we went and we said, the workers are not the ones who made the bad decisions. It's the companies who made the bad decisions. There's no reason for us to make any sacrifices. And in fact, as long as the federal government is going to control these companies, have basically majority stock, why don't, instead of making these gas-guzzling cars, why don't we build a mass transit system nationally and locally? Buses, cars, electric cars, but not at the level of just electric cars, but the trains and electric buses and so forth. So that was our idea. Then from our caucus, a few people about 5 years ago decided to start a caucus that would have essentially one plank, and that was to change the UAW constitution so that instead of electing delegates to a convention and the convention electing all the top officers, it would be one person, one vote. And to do that, to make that change, it was necessary to pass motions in various locals. And at first they were able to get some of these locals to pass the motion. But then as the administration caucus understood that we were going to try to change the system, they kind of shut that down. But at the same time, the federal government had uncovered massive fraud among this top leadership. And in fact, something like 18 top UAW officials, including who was then the current president and a previous president, were convicted of either taking money from UAW funds or taking givebacks from the corporations or from contractors. So many of them, you know, had short prison sentences. But that was a huge sea change, because it meant that a union that most of us, even those of us in the opposition, thought of as pretty clean in terms of financial accountability, turned out to be absolutely corrupt. I mean, these guys were smoking, you know, cigars that cost $2,000 and going to golf courses and staying at these fancy hotels. I mean, as if they're CEOs. I mean, it was just really shocking. And so that kind of opened things up. In fact, the UAW leadership had to agree to a federal mediator who came in to see if they could clean up the corruption. And UAWD suggested to the mediator that we should have a referendum on how we would vote. We held that referendum and we won it. Although I will say that the administration caucus decided that the way they would deal with the referendum, which of course they were opposed to, is they would ignore it. They would pretend it didn't exist. So if you're a small caucus and you're trying to get something done in the organization, but the institution itself isn't very responsive, you know, the turnout wasn't that great, but in fact we won. So once we won, we had the responsibility to try to develop a slate. And so at that point, it was, pretty difficult, but we did put forward seven nominations for the 14 seats. And frankly, I mean, I spent all winter, you know, going out to different plants at 5 a.m. Or in the afternoon, passing out these cards. And frankly, I didn't think we were going to win, you know, but in fact, things had blown open so much and there had been so much horror at the corruption that we won 5 of the 7 seats and the other 2 went to a runoff and we won those 2. So that's how we came to be the majority in the union. The problem is, of course, that we created this reform movement on the top, but we're still too small to accomplish what we need to accomplish. And that's why having the international itself motivate people to take control of ourselves is really very important, because that's how we're going to really win change for the UAW. We have to change that whole leadership, that whole culture that exists in the UAW. And, you know, it's still there because many of these leaders are still there. Hopefully some of them will come to see that our way of doing things gets results. But others of them are, you know, not committed to a member-driven organization. So these are the problems that are facing us. And of course, once we win the contract, we have a huge task ahead of us. And that is we have to go out with our good contract and try to organize all the non-union first auto plants that exist. And the better our contract, the easier it will be able to do that. Many of them are in the South, where the legislation is stacked against us. And then it seems to me we have an even larger issue, and that is we really need to be thinking about how manufacturing as a whole needs to have a strategy and a conception of itself. So I'd like to see at some point a larger union that would take that would have steel workers and auto workers and warehouse workers all be part of one big union, so that we could really work together. So that's sort of my hope.
Well, that's great, Diana. People are commenting how much they appreciate the detail and concreteness of what you presented. And I'll just say a couple of remarks. I think there's some questions waiting, but you know, sometimes small things have big impacts. I remember the auto worker caravan that you talked about. You know, somebody we both know, Wendy Thompson, came through in Syracuse when we still had a plant here producing transaxles, Chrysler and Magna. And it was had a pending shutdown and layoffs, and people working there were so demoralized with the union. So, you know, Wendy had some leaflets she wanted me to help her hand out. And, you know, I was working the graveyard shift. So I, you know, after work, I went over. It was in the morning. And one of the funny things is I was wearing my Teamster jacket. And these guys would come out and say, "Oh, the Teamsters are here. We need your help." Because they were so demoralized with the UAW. In fact, we have an auto parts factory in my Teamsters local that left the auto workers, you know, maybe 15 years ago because of their disillusion with it. So I think it's encouraging what's going on. And I think one part of the significance is a good contract, you know, will help people in other industries, but also the auto industry. You know, people think we deindustrialized. You and I were on another conversation. I can't remember the exact numbers, but there are more auto workers in the United States today than there were in 1980. The difference is something like only 20% of them are organized. Mm-hmm. So these companies like Toyota and Hyundai and Kia and BMW, they've all set up shop in the right to work states. So a good contract could speak to those workers who are, you know, working under much less good conditions. So let's see if there are any questions, or you know, Diane, you could respond to that. Chris will post some questions. Here we go. Carrie Chet Campbell. Diane Feely is correct. New union leadership has been vital in the resurgence of our union local. I am part of that new union leadership team. At 67, my union experience is valuable to our younger group. So.
Great.
Yeah. Z Manny. Diane, my impression is that UAW is getting a lot of popular support. Is that your view? And how does that impact these issues you're describing?
Yes, I think that's true. And the UAW has posted that the majority of the American population is supportive, not only of unions in general, but support what we're doing. And it's interesting, even some of the more conservative analysts, at least they were for our wage increase. But it's a much bigger group understands that it is a structural issue because of all the concessions that we've taken. And of course, the concessions, they didn't just end in auto. They exist everywhere. And so if we're able to fight against concessions, I'm sure that that will help others fight against concessions. And they take different forms, but it seems to me that a lot of the strikes are not so much about wages, but they're about the working conditions. How many students in a classroom? What is the shape that the students come to you in so that they're capable of learning? So I think that this is a much broader milieu, and also the idea that work shouldn't be our total life, that we should have a full life. You know, as Sean points out, you know, as people die and you ask them, you know, what do you regret doing in your life? They never say, oh, I regret not working more. They always say, I regret that I had to work so much. I should have been able to be there for my kids. So let's be kind to ourselves.
Z Manny, what are the legal possibilities involved regarding different unions working together? Look at the recent farmer strike in India, the largest in history. We used to have that in the US in the 1800s also.
Yes, and I would say that in the 30s, there was a relationship with the Teamsters in Minneapolis, with the farmers who were organized. And they had meetings together. They worked together. I think they even had a representative on their committee, on their joint committees. So yes, we should get together because we're not just workers, we're also consumers. And what's our problem with consumption? What's the and one other aspect that is important is, you know, when these auto plants shut down, the companies don't take responsibility for cleaning them up. So all of those pollutions are still there, costing, you know, the federal and state and local governments millions of dollars to try to clean them up. So you can't plant anything because they're so destroyed already. So corporate responsibility is really a big issue, and it should be thought of in a global way and not just in terms of the current workforce.
Z Manny, Diane, does Against the Current coordinate with other media to help enlarge audience awareness of these issues? Mainstream media often coordinates to push its narrative. Indie media coalition needed to counter.
Well, I hope we do a little bit of that. We do have a website, and we try to publish articles that we think are good from other journals, especially those that aren't part of the mainstream. For example, I just posted an article that was a speech by a Russian anti-war feminist who are against Putin's war. And I put that up, and I was really very happy that I could put that up. And they mentioned a number of women in the article. So I looked each one of them up and put a link to each one of them. It turned out that each one of them had been prosecuted, including one woman who was sentenced to 10 years in prison for putting stickers on, you may have read this, about this when it first happened. She put on the consumer items, she put expressions of being against Putin's war on those stickers. She added those to the stickers, and she was sentenced to 10 years. So we probably don't do enough. We should do more. But we're a small outfit, and hopefully we will contribute more. And we did a lot on the question of the farmers' struggle in India. We had one of our editors, Liz, in India, and we did some firsthand reports and even had some music from the farmers' struggle on there. So it's probably not enough, but some of it's really interesting.
Frankie Lee, Diane, are you confident that workers will get a very good contract from these negotiations?
Yes. I mean, already, I would say the partials that have been announced are even more than we thought was possible. It's because I think that escalating strategy has been very effective. And because, you see, before it was almost like a pretense. You know, you'd pick a company, they would know weeks in advance that they were going to be struck. So they could move parts around, they could make other arrangements. This time, they don't know what's happening. They're worried every week. And they know that if they don't continue, it's not like they can sit back and say, all right, well, we've done our offer, we're off the hook. No, the next week is coming pretty quickly, and you've got to come up with some more material. So this is not settled. And of course, as I say, I think there's a little competition between them. You know, Ford has moved ahead in terms of offering some job security that Stellantis and GM don't have yet. GM has moved ahead in terms of the battery production. So I think it's going to be a very good contract. And I think that's partly the result of the strategy that has been used in the negotiations with the escalation, and the fact that people on the picket lines are so highly motivated. So, for example, during the first week of the strike, two of the plants were close to each other. One in Toledo, Ohio, which is very close to the Michigan border, and one, the Ford Michigan assembly plant, which is near the Metro airport. So they're less than an hour apart. So the people who make the Jeep said, all right, we're going to caravan to Michigan assembly and show our solidarity. Well, they came, it happened to be the day that I was there, and I saw them. They were so enthusiastic, and they had decorated their cars, and there were flags, and they were hanging out of the Jeeps, and it was just a big show, you know. Well, then the Michigan Assembly people said, well, we've got to take a caravan to Toledo. And then Wentzville, which is near St. Louis and didn't have anybody around, they said, well, we can caravan to different parts of our plant. And then last Sunday, local 51 on the east side of Detroit said, well, we belong to Region 1 and some of our plants are on strike. Why don't we organize a motorcycle brigade and a car caravan and go to all the plants? So I was picketing at Mopar, which is owned by Stellantis, when they came by, and the regional director gets out and comes and shakes everybody's hand. It's spontaneous. It's wonderful. And it's not controlled by some international body. It's just, this is what you do. You think of ideas, you know. And I'll just give one more example, and that is, someone in DSA was talking to one of the workers at a plant, and they said, yeah, you know, we have scabs coming in here. It's a parts distribution plant. We have scabs coming in here. There are supervisors who are required to work 10 hours a day, but they're also hiring a few scabs. It's hard to get them, but, you know, whatever they get. And they tell them to park their car way far away, and they'll take a bus in. So my friend started talking, and of course, the picket lines are only allowed. They've worked out that they can stop the vehicles from going in for only 5 minutes. And after that, the police will start arresting people. Well, they don't want to have those arrests, so they allow the cars and buses and trucks to go in after 5 minutes. And sometimes you can make it 10 minutes, but, you know, okay. But we went out this morning at 8 o'clock. We knew that the bus would be coming between 8 and 8:30. And there were about 25 of us. And we just, 2 blocks away from the plant, we just knew where they were coming. We knew they had to come this way or that way. And we walked slowly around on the street. And then the bus came, and actually it was a school bus. And everybody said, oh, it's a school bus. I said, no, it's Saturday. It's not a school bus. There are no kids in there. And it turned out there weren't. And so as they saw us walking around, you know, they called up and they got a truck, big truck to come in. But of course, it, you know, it took them about 20 minutes or 25 minutes to get the cops to come. And of course, we weren't interested in being arrested. We were just going to stand there and try to slow everything down. So they all got to work late. Great. And that was just an action. And we said, no, we're not part of the UAW. We're just supporters. So, you know, these kinds of spontaneous actions happen when people talk to each other and feel they have the right to do things. They're not told, no, you can't talk to the press. In fact, the International had a Zoom meeting to teach people how to tell their stories to the press. So this is just, you know, it's a whole different game plan.
And that energy feeds on itself. I mean, you know, you really have a movement when, you know, I'm thinking I observed in the Sanders campaign in 2016, his campaign was not prepared to absorb all the people that wanted to do stuff. So they started doing it themselves, and it built upon itself and really built its movement. And, you know, keeping that openness is, I think, key. I think that's an important lesson, you know, from this strike and some other experiences. But we had a question up there. Yeah, we go. Oh, Chris Blankenhorn. I'm excited to see new tactics from one of our bigger unions. Hopefully success in this strike will inspire reforming culture and tactics from some other big dinosaur unions that have seemed to become more collaborationist over the years.
Yes, but I don't think it's going to happen unless there are some people who are dedicated to changing things. Because, you know, people develop so few expectations. It's amazing how, you know, life and culture in the United States encourages you just to think small. So how can you build a caucus where you can help each other and stimulate each other and then find a way of bringing that into the larger union? And that's the only way I think you're going to find change. So I'm very much for focusing on developing some kinds of teams at the local level so that you can build. This is how TDU did it. This is how we've historically done it in the UAW, although we've done it on a shoestring. I mean, UAWD has been much bigger and more successful, but there have always been opposition caucuses.
I think one lesson from that kind of experience is if you don't organize even small teams, you're just by yourself. And you're right. Ralph Nader always says we need to raise our expectations. You know, we're accepting too little, but if people don't see anything going on, they settle for that. But when you have a small team, at least people that want to do something have somewhere where they can work together. And then a lot of times, a lot of people are agreeing with you. They're just skeptical that you can win anything. And then when you start to get some momentum, you know, they show up and say, we were with you the whole time. And you got a real movement going on. So I think that's one thing I've been preaching on these podcasts is there's no such thing as a unorganized socialist. You gotta be working with people, and it makes you smarter. It educates you as well as the people you're working with.
So I want to make sure that everybody sees that there are now 5 assembly plants and 38 parts distribution sites, and that's more than it's almost half the states that exist where you can go to the picket lines. And if you can't go there, of course they have distributors everywhere, you know, that are affiliated, you know, repair shops that are affiliated with the big three. So you can go and leaflet them. We're not asking for you to picket them. There's no strike action, but you can go and use that spot as a way of educating people about the issues of the strike.
Yeah, I don't know if we ever posted the links to the Diane's recent report, which has links to the, there it goes, strike map. This is going up now. Okay, Z Manny, Diane, this is a huge point about our culture. Encourages us to think small, individual, atomized, fragmented.
Yeah, and what Howie said, you know, if you're a socialist, then you should think, how can you make a change? And, it's small, especially, you know, when I would go into work, I would think about, okay, what can I say today? And it can only be 30 seconds. You know, you can't go and preach to people, but you can talk about, TV shows or events. You can raise something. You don't finish the conversation because you hope by dropping that into people's lives or posting something that somebody will come to you. What happened to me once, I posted in the women's dressing room an article from an African-American paper about domestic violence. Because the majority of my workforce, you know, were blacks, mostly black women, you know, in assembly. And within 5 minutes, someone came to my job and said, I once was married to an abuser. I got myself out of that situation, but I want to work with you so that if we discover other people here who are in that situation, we can do something about it. And of course, that was an African-American woman. So we worked very closely together. I was mostly her backup because I wasn't going to go to black women and talk about this. That would be really inappropriate for me. But we worked together, and that was something that we did. Well, we had other campaigns as well. So when the International said our plant had to vote for two-tier, and we could not, because of all the bureaucrats, we could not get a motion to put a pin out, no two-tier. And I said, I wanna get a button, even if I have to put it out myself. So my friend said, well, why don't you put out a leaflet in the plant asking for donations? Well, I did. And people started coming to me, giving me a dollar bill, $5 bill. And at first I was trying to keep a list, you know, so I could pay people back. But then I realized they didn't want to be paid back. They were just giving me the money. So I went out, I got 1,000 buttons, and I got another 1,000 buttons. And we had a huge campaign. And I went into the break room one night, and somebody sitting there explaining to another person why we have to be against two-tier using exactly my arguments. And I'm thinking, gee, we've won here. We had 50 people distributing this button on the different shifts. We had three shifts, different plants, and we turned it down by 53%. Unfortunately, we were only one of five plants, and the other plants accepted it because, of course, not only did the company tell them that they would lose their job, but the international at that point went and said, well, those people in Detroit, you know, they have a secure job, but you don't have a secure job. And that's why you have to vote for two-tier. So really nasty the way they used us against each other. So at any rate, you have to keep going and know that there's opposition and that, you know, you're right, Howie, that if you win, suddenly people who were against you will at least be neutralized, and some of them will actually admit they made a mistake. They're going to change.
And the people that were hopeless, suddenly they got hope and they're more active. I mean, when I worked at UPS, in the Teamsters Union, you know, I talk about, you know, grievances and I, you know, participate in that part of it. But I was also known, you know, just in the larger community as a political activist. And when news happened, even people that would never vote would come up to me at break or after work and say, explain to me what's going on with this issue. So it's not like people were apathetic. I think they were more alienated from thinking they could ever make a difference. But, you know, if you get known as one of those people, and every workplace has them, you know, if there's an issue, there's some people that a lot of people look to, you know, for like, help us figure out what's going on or, you know, tell us what you think about this. So, you know, I think that's important. You know, you should just be, not a preacher, but more a listener. You know, you can put out some statements and, you know, get people thinking and they know you're thinking and then, you know, they'll come to you and just listen and build a relationship.
And maybe they'll even agree to do something with you. I mean, I had a guy and I will say he was certainly much more to my right than to my left. But he agreed with the question of two-tier. And he said, I'll help you. I said, well, why don't you write the next leaflet? And he went off. He came back and he said, gee, I can't get started. So I had a break and I sat down on a piece of cardboard and I started writing something out. I gave it to him as an idea. He came back with a leaflet the next day. You know, it isn't exactly the leaflet that I would have written, but it was written by somebody else. And how you build a team. He understood that he could do what he wanted. You know, he was a free agent. He wasn't, you know, had to be my sidekick or something. So yeah, it's really good if you can find a teammate, even one, and then that gets it going. And one other thing, while I was working in the plant, we had a newspaper strike here, which went on for like 5 years and was really a total disaster. But it had the union newspaper that came out once a week. And I sold 100 copies of that newspaper in front of and inside my plant every week. And that is really what helped make me a well-known as somebody who knew what was happening. So I agree with Howie about that point.
Okay, so our hour is up. And I think it's been really valuable. I hope people will promote this on social media, because I think if you want to find out what's going on with the UAW strike and also, you know, some good ideas about labor organizing, I think we've heard a lot of that from Diane. So I think this is going to be valuable if it gets circulated. So thank you, Diane. That was great. And I noticed in the chat, particularly early until Diane really got their attention. And people were finally able to focus. They were, you know, fretting about Cornel West leaving the Greens. And that needs to be talked about. So we'll focus on that next week. Just have a question and answer session. There's also this new war in Israel-Palestine that probably people are going to want to talk about. So that's what we'll do next week. And thanks for being here today, and I hope y'all have a good week.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Join a picket line.